time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. Welcome to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. In this show, we talk all about sleep and the science behind sleep, hoping to help you, let's try it that way, get better sleep. So our guest today is Dr. Michael Gramner, and he is a PhD working with sleep and sleep medicine. So Dr. Gramner, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we've got a lot of things to cover today. And I'm just going to kind of start randomly, and we'll move around as the conversation goes.
Sounds good.
So one of the things that got me to invite you on as a guest in the first place was I know you do a lot of work and study with sleep diaries. And sleep diaries, for those of you listening, are things typically used by people to track their sleep so that when they need help with their sleep, the doctors, the professionals can help them understand what's going on. So can you give us an overall view? What are sleep diaries? Why do we even have them? And how are they used in the sleep field?
Yeah, a lot of people wonder, why do we still use sleep logs and sleep diaries when we have things like wearable devices and brainwave recordings for sleep? And the truth is that you can measure things with sleep logs that you can't measure with the technology we have. We've got great technology for measuring sleep, but you know, we're not there yet in terms of getting optimal measures. And that's okay. There's many areas in medicine that we've got made great progress in, but we're still not there yet. For example, pain, a very important symptom, but you know, we have MRIs, we have all kinds of scanning we can do, but it can't find our pain. You have to ask people. And when it comes to certain aspects of sleep, we don't yet have the technology to measure it, especially things like insomnia. So we can look at brainwave activity during sleep, but that won't necessarily pick up what people are thinking about because sometimes that's deeper in the brain. And we can use wearables and trackers to get all kinds of great information about sleep, but you know, we still don't have the technology to measure things like how long did it feel like it took? That perception of the passage of time seems to be really important at predicting symptoms. Not necessarily the exact number of minutes, but how many minutes did it feel like? Was it 40 minutes but felt like 20? Or could it be 40 minutes and felt like 100? That could mean different things. And so this is why we need sleep diaries, because they give us information we just don't have the ability to get any other way. Sleep diaries predict outcomes better than any technology we have in some cases, especially around insomnia. So that's why we need them. So what do we use? So sleep diaries, they're not like, so we use the term diary, but it's not like, you know, dear diary, I had a hard time falling asleep. It's more of a log. And so we're looking for very specific information. And I even show patients who come into the clinic and I say, look, here's the information I'm getting for you and here's what I'm doing with it. I am literally doing hundreds of calculations on every week's worth of data and using those calculations to generate numbers. And those numbers will give me the information I need to come up with the best tailored solution for your problem. And this is it's very science-based. The field has been using these for decades. We know how to use them, and there's actually really great numbers we can get. So what the sleep diaries usually are trying to measure are mostly getting a timeline of the night. There's other things too, but the core of any sleep diary is getting a timeline of the night. So you're getting at least, when did your sleep period begin? When did your sleep period end? And then what happened in the middle? So things like, what time did you get into bed? I also ask, what time did you actually start trying to fall asleep? Because some people get into bed and they're reading or doing something else. And then I ask, once you started trying to fall asleep, how long did it take you? And then I ask, how many times do you remember waking up during the night? For how long? I actually, in the beginning, I don't care what time the awakenings were, and I don't care how long each one was, mostly because people aren't going to get that level of detail accurate anyway. But really the point is, what's the total amount of time people were awake during the night? And then I ask, what time did you actually wake up to never go back to sleep again? And then when did you actually get out of bed? Because for most people, those are two different times. They'll wake up and then they'll linger in bed for a while, then get up. With those pieces of information, I can calculate all kinds of interesting stuff. Most importantly, I can see what is the total window of opportunity that you were able to sleep, and where in the 24 hours was that? Of that 24-hour window, what proportion of that was actually spent in bed? Because you might have got, because I'll also ask, you know, if you were awake, how much time did you get up and get out of bed? I didn't mention that earlier, but I often ask about that. So I could see how much of their sleep opportunity was actually spent in bed. And of the time they were spending in bed, how much of that was actually trying to sleep? And of the time that of your sleep opportunity where you were actually in bed trying to sleep, how much of that time were you actually asleep? And so now we have these different windows. And what we look at is the proportion and the relationship between those windows. Was most of the time you were in bed actually attempting to sleep? And of the time you were attempting to sleep, how much of that was actually spent asleep? Those numbers become the foundation for a lot of the recommendations we can give. And then you have the specific numbers too that figure in terms of time to fall asleep, awakenings during the night, how much time awake during the night, and how much time you're lingering in bed in the morning. All those things become relevant in the context of those different ratios and proportions that we look at. And we can use that information to guide targeted, science-based sleep strategies that There's a toolbox of them that use these numbers, and what they've generally outperformed. And actually, there's no study that's shown that any prescription medication has outperformed some of these strategies, yet they have outperformed prescription medications. So there's a whole bunch of things we can do with this information. How exactly we get it can differ. Sometimes it's written in paper, sometimes it's in an app. Sometimes we ask it in terms of a question. Sometimes we have people fill out a grid of like, I went to bed here, I woke up here. It depends on the question. It depends. Different people have different preferences. But at their core, that's the information that you're getting out of sleep diaries. And that's why they're important. And that's why numbers are important. Because if I say, how long did it take you to fall asleep? And you say, I don't know, felt like a long time. Well, I can't run calculations on it felt like a long time. Because if I need to calculate what proportion of the time was spent trying to sleep, and part of that calculation is a long time, what does that mean? So right. So that's why we need actual numbers.
So let me play skeptic here for a second.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm sure you've had this question a million times, and anyone who practices in the area of sleep, behavioral sleep medicine, has had this question a million times. So on one hand, you're telling us about sleep diaries, and you're telling us how all this data is helpful for you to be able to help us do, you know, improve our sleep and all this. And on the other hand, you're saying that, you know, we don't need it to be perfect because we could, you know, the typical question is, well, I have an Apple Watch, I have a Fitbit, I have a tracker. You're telling me if I wake up in the middle of the night to recognize how long I was awake, but you don't want me to look at my clock. So how do I know how long I was actually? So all the data I'm giving you, Doc, is my guess. I mean, I could be way off. I don't know. And then you're using that data to treat me. It doesn't make sense to me. Why aren't you just using my Apple Watch?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is because the Apple Watch can't tell me the information I actually need to make a decision. Because it's not about how many minutes it was. It's about how many minutes it felt like it was. And so what that means is, if I base, and we know this from clinical trials data, actually this has been tested, that if you make the decision of how to guide people's therapy based on wearable data, you don't get the same good outcomes as if you guide therapy based on the diary data. So a great example of how this would work is, let's say you come into clinic. The actual number of minutes it takes you to fall asleep is 37, but it feels like 47. And then at the end of therapy, the actual number of minutes it takes you to fall asleep is 20. But really, it feels like 10 to you. And so in your mind, what felt like almost 50 minutes is now reduced to 10, which dramatically reduces your stress. It dramatically reduces your fear around sleep. It dramatically reduces the anxiety you have around sleep, which is fueling the inability to sleep. But we've reduced that stress and anxiety, where the actual number of minutes maybe changed from 47 to 20, but if, or 37 to 20, but it changed, felt like a much bigger difference. And that change in your perception, those number of minutes actually predict things like lowered risk for depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, chronic pain, even neurodegenerative conditions like dementia. By that perception that your sleep is better, that actually is predicting the outcomes we care about. And so patients are like, but why, if it's not the true number? And what I'm saying is, you don't know that it isn't. You're assuming that the number that's predicting the outcome, the biological variable that's predicting the outcome, is the number of minutes it's taking you to fall asleep, for example. But maybe that's not the number. Maybe the number that's predicting the outcome is the degree of brain activation in structures in the brain that are active in terms of sensing the perception of time, informing memory, and processing information at a time when they should be resting. They're active when they're not supposed to be. Right. And that is preventing them from doing the proper recovery systems that they're supposed to be engaging in. So actually you can't measure directly those things. We don't have the technology for that yet.
Right.
But it gets picked up in the diary in that it feels like it's going better. So it's downstream. It's an echo of the real number, but we can't actually measure the real number. And so what we have is a fuzzy picture of reality. But I would rather a fuzzy picture that's true as opposed to a clear picture that is pointing in the wrong direction. And because we don't know exactly biologically what's happening, and there's science going on to try and understand this, it's hard to do in humans. You can't open up their brains. They tend not to like that. So we have to go in these indirect ways, which is what takes longer. And it's harder to understand, and we're getting there. All we know is that if you make clinical decisions based on a diary, you get the outcomes you want. But if you make the clinical decisions based on the wearables, you might be going off of more clear, accurate information, but it might be the wrong information. And actually, the truth might be baked into the diary in a way it's not. The wearable data are true. They just might not be the true value that actually predicted the outcome that you wanted. And so we're still learning all this. You got to remember, wearable data have been around for decades. We've been using them for decades. But they've only been in widespread use for, 10 years? Mm-hmm. You're like, we're still trying to figure out how to work these things and how to understand these numbers at scale. You know, it takes time, and we're still figuring this stuff out.
Wow. So that really helps, because it's really, like you said, it's about the perceptions and what's going on, because those are the things that impact an individual's ability to actually get restful sleep versus the actual number. So with that, let me ask this.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these wearables will give you a report and says, oh, you had this much stage one sleep and this much stage two and this much stage sleep. Are those accurate at all? And if they are or if they aren't, does it matter?
Okay, great question. Two great questions. So one, sleep stage data. Are sleep stage data accurate from wearables?
Right.
Kinda, a little bit. They're not nothing. They're good ballpark estimates. But what you have to understand is, well, first of all, to answer your second question, are they useful? Probably not, mostly. But to get at the initial question, what are sleep stages? Sleep stages, what people need to understand, sleep stages aren't like these magical things that give you all the information you need to know about sleep. They're one way of understanding sleep. What sleep stages are in the 1930s and 40s, when people first started putting electrodes on people's heads to measure the electrical activity coming off the brain, and you see the squiggly lines on the screen as voltage changes over time. And what they found was the voltage patterns of the changing voltage during wake was very different from during sleep. And then when they kept them on, they noticed that actually the voltage patterns, the squiggly line patterns that you get during sleep, follow an interesting pattern in that sometimes in sleep they are a little more similar to wake, just kind of slowed down a little bit. During other parts of sleep, you get these other different kinds of waves. And during this other parts of sleep, you get these other kinds of waves that look different. And you get them at different times during the night. It's not just one progression across the night. They're like goes through sort of cycles. And they figured this out in the 1930s and 40s. And what they did is they looked at the squiggly lines, which was pen on paper. Where at the time, remember, none of this is digital. This is all analog. And as they were recording it, and they're looking at these paper, and one sheet of paper covered about 30 seconds of time. And so they said, okay, this 30 seconds, which bucket? So they come up with about four different buckets to put things in. And they changed a little bit over what the buckets were, sort of changed a little bit over time. But they came up with about four different buckets of like, okay, this looks like bucket A, B, C, or D, or stage 1, 2, 3, 4. And then one sort of got split into REM and stage one, and then eventually 3 and 4 kind of got combined with each other. But it's like we generally have four different buckets. Which bucket do we put it in? Based on a human looking at the squiggly lines and saying, which pattern does this kind of look like? Sort of like in Severance, where they're circling the numbers and like, which bucket does this feel like? And there's a lot of subjectivity to it. Do sleep stages exist in nature? Kinda. But we made them up. We decided how many buckets there were, and we kept changing our minds. And we decided what counts as one bucket versus another, and we can't even agree because you need a human to look at it. No one can trust any of the computer raters yet because there's a lot of gray in the interpretation. So sleep stages themselves are It's not very clear. It's not a really obvious, objective thing. It's always been a little bit subjective based on human perception and human categorization of about four buckets, because that's about how many buckets humans can handle kind of at once, apparently. And so what is a sleep stage? And so the buckets themselves, based on brainwave activity. What is a brainwave? Do people even know what a brainwave is? What brainwaves are, it's the squiggly lines that happen when you put an electrode on the scalp. So what is it actually measuring? It's measuring electrical activity in the brain. In the whole brain? Nope. It's measuring the electrical activity just on the very outer layer of the brain, mostly. It's sort of like if there is a party happening on the other side of this wall, and I press my ear up against the wall, what am I going to hear? I'm not going to hear the conversations in the whole room. I'm going to hear what's closest to the wall with any clarity. And the rest might be background noise, but if there's a lot of it, I'll hear a lot of background noise. That's sort of what the EEG signal measures, that it's measuring this fluctuation in electrical activity. But it's also when people... So first of all, it's only pretty much just the outer layers of the brain. And that's not where sleep is. Sleep biology, the biology of the parts of the brain that really control sleep and determine what happens in sleep and drive sleep, that's all very, very deep in the brain. That's brainstem, midbrain, hypothalamus stuff that we do not have the technology to measure directly in humans because we're not going to like drill deep down into people's brains. We can't do that. So we can't measure sleep directly. Even the brainwave activity that we measure is not the brainwave activity that drives what sleep is. It's an echo of an echo of an echo of something downstream of something downstream of what the core of what sleep is. But wow. It's still something. You dump a chemical in the river, you'll still pick it up downstream, but you're not picking it up at its source. You're picking it up after it interacted with the environment and other stuff later. So it's not a perfect measure, even if it is. And you're not even measuring neurons firing because you don't have the resolution. Neurons fire in 1/1000th of a second, and our sampling rate can't pick that up. So what we're picking up is the background electrical activity that's happening in the outer layers of the cortex that changes with sleep, and it does predictably. But again, it is very far downstream of what actually sleep is. So right. The EEG signal itself, what sleep stages are biologically useful and important, but they're not usually the core of what people are asking about. So again, it's about, what are you actually measuring? Are you measuring something that you want? So scientists look at it because we're looking at brain function during sleep and what's happening. But like a normal person looking at sleep stages, does it matter? Your body, it's like, so when people are worrying about their sleep stages, to me that's like saying, when a patient comes in and says, hey, I'm worried I'm not getting enough stage N3 sleep or stage REM sleep or whatever, I'll say like, well, are you worried about how much oxygen your lungs are exchanging, you know, when you breathe? It's like, no. It's like, well, why not? It's like, well, because it's fine. And I'm like, well, dude, so it would be like complaining about that and saying like, well, I want my O2 sat to be 99%, but it's 95% or 96%. Is that bad? It's like, okay, well, do you have any lung disease? Any reason why it wouldn't be working properly?
Mm-hmm.
If so, then we could deal with that. If it's not, then let's look in the environment. Is your air polluted? Is there any reason why, or are you hypoxic? Are you on an airplane? Are you at altitude? Is there a reason why you'd have low O2? No. Like, well, your lungs are doing their job. Let them be. Like, if you feel fine, there's no reason why it's a problem. It's your body's making these choices. And the same thing with sleep stages, where if there's no reason to be worried about them, they're not really a sign. Like, they could be very wildly different from what the norm is, and it won't mean anything. It could be a sign of a problem, but usually it's not. And then they're getting it from a wearable. You're not, remember, sleep stages are, which bucket would we put the brain waves in that we recorded at the scalp in 30-second intervals if a human looked at it and made a judgment call?
Right.
Guessing that from heart rate and movement data at the wrist, the fact that it's so accurate, it's about 60 to 80% accurate, depending on the person and the stage and the night. The fact that it's even that accurate is a miracle. You're playing two games of telephone going in very different directions, one to peripheral data at the wrist, one to EEG data. The fact that they agree so much is amazing. But expecting them to agree close to 100%, I think, is unrealistic, because you're measuring two totally different processes that will still fluctuate during the night, and they'll overlap a bit, but not exactly. So that's also why I say it's not nothing, it's not junk. It's actually, if you look at sleep staging data from the EEG and from the wrist, and you look at them side by side, if the algorithms are good, and some of the devices have quite good algorithms, you can tell it's the same person on the same night. Will they agree at every minute? They'll agree maybe 70, 80% of the time, but you'll still see the same pattern. So, right. Like, it's useful, but I actually mostly ignore those data besides just looking at it broadly.
Wow. Well, that's a very comprehensive answer, and I appreciate that. But these are questions that I get from my own clients, and I'm sure you do too.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'm going to have to stop us. I'm going to stop us real quick because we've got to do a commercial break here.
Okay.
And we'll be right back, and I got a lot more questions for you. So
excellent.
Join us back on Sleep Science Today right after the commercial break.
If you're having trouble sleeping and you need support, don't go it alone. Join us at our free online support group at sleepsupportgroup.com. Just put in your email address, sign up for the list, and you will be notified of all of our upcoming meetings. It's free, so why not try it out?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we're back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking with Dr. Michael Randner, and we're talking about, well, we've been talking about sleep diaries and sleep data and sleep trackers, but I want to move to a different topic now. What do you do in the case where a patient comes to you and they say, Doc, I have not slept a wink in like 2 weeks, it seems, and I go into bed and all I can do is just toss and turn. Can you just give me a pill and put an end to my misery? What's actually going on with insomnia and pills and other treatments? Tell us what we need to know.
Yeah, so first of all, I will say I'm a psychologist, so I'm not prescribing nothing, but I don't need to. There's a couple things going on here. First of all, every once in a while, people will come in and say, I haven't slept at all in, you know, days. Or even, like, they'll say I got, like, 2 to 3 hours of sleep a night. And that's very unlikely. And so then I'll ask, well, do you give yourself an opportunity? Are you spending time in bed? And they'll say, yes, often. So what that says to me, first of all, is that they're spending excessive time in bed not sleeping. What is likely the case is that they're actually getting a little more sleep than they think, because there's in many people with insomnia, you get an element of what's called paradoxical insomnia. And it's called that because there's a discrepancy between the person's experience and what the numbers say. Remember before I talked about the numbers aren't always the thing that predicts the outcome we care about. Sometimes the perception is really important. What happens when the perception is so far different from the numbers? You can get people, you put them in the lab, biologically their sleep can look totally normal, and then, or mostly normal, and they'll say, I barely slept at all. I was awake all night. I don't remember sleeping at all. Well, which is true? Were they wrong? Or was the machine wrong? The real answer is, it seems to be complicated and both true. They were probably getting more biological sleep than they remember, but the quality they were getting was probably poor and fragmented. So if they were up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down, their brain probably connected those dots and perceived that as continuous wakefulness, in where they didn't see the sleep interruption so much. They didn't perceive that, even though it was actually there. So there's a lot of paradoxical insomnia. So some people, it's their experience and the numbers line up fairly well. For some people, it's very different. For those people, often, actually, I'll put a wearable on them and I'll say, look, even if this wearable data isn't totally accurate, you're still probably getting a lot more sleep than you think. So when you're laying there terrified of not sleeping, one thing you can just tell yourself that, okay, I'm actually getting more sleep than I thought, and we can work on that relaxing a little bit and not being as stressed. But there probably is insomnia. And there's a huge problem of insomnia in the population. And chronic insomnia, for whatever other elements are in it, a lot of people don't realize that there's a million causes of short-term insomnia, but there's only one main cause of chronic insomnia. And that is conditioned arousal. What that means is that something causes you to lose sleep. Anything can do that. Losing sleep for a couple nights under periods of stress, that's fine. There's no problem with that. You know, evolution figured this out a long time ago. It's actually quite safe, and you know, you might have a little bit of performance impairment, but you'll recover very quickly. But when it extends over time, you start developing a pattern. And when sleep starts to become predictably stressful, that predictable stress becomes the very activation that creates your insomnia. Now, what I mean by this is that think of a place that you hate to go. A lot of people say dentist's office. I have a friend who's a dentist who hates that I keep using this analogy. But people know what I mean. What is the dentist's office for you? Where you're there, nothing's happened yet, you're already kind of antsy. You're on your way there, and you're already kind of antsy. You're making the call to set up the appointment in 6 months, and you're already kind of antsy. Like, that place is so predictably tied with a psychophysiological state that you put yourself in that state without even being there, much right. less you're there, and nothing even happened to promote that state yet.
Because it's the DMV, not the dentist. Right. The DMV is okay. worse DMV. Than the dentist.
The DMV. Whatever it is for you, imagine that. Imagine that that place is so, it's a learned response. You train, your brain is trained well. Your brain is a pattern recognition machine. It learned the pattern, and it learned it really well. The difference is, you go to the DMV, and even if you're in a bad mood and cranky, you can still get everything done that needs to be done there. But with sleep, if the bed, if the act of falling asleep, if the bedroom becomes that place that creates that feeling, now, even if you were completely calm and relaxed and tired and exhausted, having trouble keeping your eyes open, and then you get into bed, and the bed is now the place where activation happens. So you get into bed and activate, because you learned that trying to fall asleep is stressful, and that creates stress, which makes it hard to fall asleep, which strengthens the relationship between trying to fall asleep and stress. So tomorrow you get into bed and you're stressed about falling asleep before anything even happened, which created activation that made it harder to fall asleep, and it becomes a cycle, a completely self-perpetuating cycle. Whatever caused you to lose sleep originally is now potentially and likely completely irrelevant. You got used to whatever it was, whether it was pain or an illness or work stress or whatever, it's past. But the effects have lingered because they became their own self-perpetuating cycle, where now you're the energy in the system keeping you awake. You added it, it came out of nowhere. It just, you came in there with no energy, but just being in the place adds energy into the system, which then makes it harder to fall asleep. So the treatments for insomnia, the reason why the non-medication treatments outperform prescription sedatives is because what the non-medication treatments usually do, and when they're done correctly, this is what they do, is they reprogram that response. They uncouple the act of falling asleep with the stress and activation, and they repair the act of falling asleep with sedation and tiredness. And it's learning process.
I'm going to jump in and cut you off here on purpose because we need to take another commercial break, but I want to be able to come back and talk about exactly where you're headed. So
excellent.
Let's take another break, and we'll be back on Sleep Science Today.
Have you ever wondered why you can't sleep well? Well, there could be lots of different reasons. In order to figure it out, I wrote the book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? It includes 150 common sleep questions that are asked and answered, and I provide all of the supporting science and evidence to address each of the questions. I encourage you to get a copy of Why Can't I Sleep Well by Andrew Kolsky.
It's available at www.sleepsciencetoday.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tennis Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the Skin Comfort Formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
All right, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We were talking about non-medication solutions for insomnia and why and how they work. So, doctor, take it away.
All right, so we were talking about the non-medication treatments for insomnia and how they alter that learning process. So sedatives will work by boosting that sleep drive so high that it overpowers whatever active wakefulness is going on, and that's sometimes enough. That's usually how the sedative medications work. That's also why sometimes they don't work as well as people think, because their sleep drive might be high enough. It's just that that activation is so high, it can overpower them. So this is why the non-medication approaches are recommended, because that's how they work. So the way we do it. So there's a couple of core techniques. And I'll preface this by saying, in a nutshell, in a summary, they sound very simple. But whenever you try to do them, you'll realize that the execution and how it's done and how it's targeted is what where the skill comes in. But if you're going to do this on your own, here's the first thing I would do. The first thing I would do is I would challenge you to first thing is uncouple wakefulness with the bed in any shape or form, which means do not get into bed until you're ready. If you know that going into bed, it's still going to take a while, wait, delay bedtime. So again, this is all short term. This isn't a permanent thing, but delay bedtime until you either you can't keep your eyes open or until you're like, you know what, I think sleep could be imminent. Then you get into bed. If you cannot fall asleep, and what that means is rule of thumb is I would say 20, 30 minutes. If you're in there for 20, 30 minutes, it's not happening by then get up. If you're in bed and maybe 20 minutes hasn't gone by, and again, the exact time doesn't matter, so don't look at the clock. It's just if you've been in there long enough that sleep is not actually imminent, get up. You're clearly not ready. Even if you thought you were ready, you're not ready. If you're in bed and you start getting frustrated about not sleeping, eject. You're out. Because that frustration is now keeping sleep from occurring. So they're incompatible with each other. You got to get out. Like, but I don't want to. I'm like, what if I sleep way less tonight? Great. You will operate just fine tomorrow, probably. Like most people, you know, have experienced a night of crappy sleep and they didn't die. Like, but what will happen is the next day you'll be a little more tired. And whatever activation you had now has a counterweight of your additional sleep pressure. Don't nap. Don't dissipate that sleep pressure. Hold it and then discharge it at night to overpower that activation. And if you wake up during the night and you can't get back to sleep, same thing. You get up, you wait. If you're trying to eat and you're sitting in front of this plate of food and you are just not hungry and you have no appetite, sitting there staring at your food for an hour is not going to make you hungry. You may eventually get hungry and eat, but if you have an appetite issue and you sit there and stare at your food for an hour every day before you can stomach eating, mealtime is going to start becoming stressful itself on its own. That's what you want to break. You want to break that cycle. And so you want to challenge yourself to spend as little time in bed awake as possible. Then the other core, so that's a core concept in managing insomnia, sort of breaking that connection. And another core concept is about how do you know when that learning process is engaged? And this comes back to our discussion of the sleep diaries, where one of the numbers that comes out of the sleep diary is a number called sleep efficiency. What sleep efficiency is, it's a fraction, it's a ratio, it's a percentage, where the numerator is the total time you are physically asleep, or at least by your own estimate, because it doesn't have to be exact and it's all based on your perception. The minutes of perceived sleep divided by the minutes of an actual sleep opportunity. So if you spend 8 hours in bed and get 6 hours of sleep, 6/8 is 75%. So you have a 75% sleep efficiency. Now, so that's how you calculate your sleep efficiency. Now, we've known for decades now that there's a learning process that occurs at around 85-90%. Below about 85%, and I say about, everyone's a little different, but below about 85%, the bed is not specifically tied as predictable enough for sleep. Over 90%, it looks like that's where the learning really occurs, where the bed is predictably tied to sleep. And 85 to 90 is sort of this middle ground where it may or may not happen. But then when your sleep efficiency drops lower, like 70, 70, 65%, and it's, or even lower, the bed becomes trained to be the place where you're not sleeping. And a lot of these techniques are about, what I'll tell people is, we're going to artificially inflate your sleep efficiency number so that even if your numerator stays low, because we can't move that yet, but at least we lower your denominator. If we want bed to equal sleep, we can't change the sleep side of the equation yet, at least we can control the bed side of the equation, get them lined up, force that learning to occur so that it becomes sticky, so that they become tied together, then we can expand. So for example, so the way I teach this is I say, how does this learning work? If I say bed, sleep, bed, sleep, bed, sleep, bed, sleep, bed, sleep, bed, sleep. If I say bed, you say?
Sleep.
Right. So if I say bed, sleep, bed, think, bed, sleep, bed, read, bed, think, bed, wake, bed, think, bed, sleep, bed, think, bed, read, bed, you have no idea. You don't know what's going to happen yet.
So you,
yeah, right. And then what happens is bed, think, bed, think, bed, think, bed, sleep, bed, think, bed, think, bed, think, bed, think, bed, sleep, bed, think, bed, worry, bed, think. You can actually predict that thinking and worrying is going to happen. And it takes over. And you accidentally created that learning. So when we unpair, there's no bed. If there's think, there's no bed. If there's toss and turn, there's no bed. And so you pair bed with sleep on purpose. And you force that learning to occur. And in the short term, it becomes stickier, and then you can expand. So when people say, well, I want to run that half marathon of sleep, and should I start with a 5K? I say, no, we're starting by hitting the gym. We're not going distance yet. we're getting your body ready for it to be able to operate. So yes, you're going to sleep. You're probably not going to sleep much less than usual, but you're going to be in bed a lot less. We're going to inflate that sleep efficiency number, and then we are going to, once that sleep efficiency is high, and we drive that learning in, we leverage that learning and use that to build your own natural ability to sleep that was there all along.
Wow. This is actually, it's a perfect segue because we literally have just reached the end of our time on the show. And boy, do I have so many other questions for you. So maybe I can convince you to come back on another episode because yeah. I want to learn more about so many other things. But, excellent. You know, the fact that people can benefit from the treatments available for insomnia, the fact that they don't need to rely upon a pill, the fact that we have, you know, on one hand, we're moving forward with all this technology and wearables and all these things, but on the other hand, they're nice, but they're not, you know, imperative.
Yeah.
This has really been very instructive, and I thank you for taking the time. Any last words for us? Anything that you think we need to make sure we know before we sign off?
Yeah, a great thing to remember: the enemy of sleep is effort. No one got to sleep faster by trying harder. And if you find yourself struggling, sometimes the best thing you can do is stop struggling. Just do something else for a while. You can't make yourself hungry. You can't make yourself sleepy. You kind of have to just be there when it happens and let your body take over. And so if you find yourself exerting effort, it's likely backfiring. And sometimes removing the effort is what opens the door for sleep to occur.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
For those of you, you know, listening to the show, we try to bring you experts like this, like Dr. Grandner, to really explain the science behind what's going on. I think it's important that people really understand what they're dealing with rather than just getting some TV commercial somewhere about something. So please feel free to join us at www.sleepsciencetoday. You'll be able to get links to our podcast, the radio show, the YouTube channel, all the other information we put out there for you, trying to help you to improve your sleep. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and we will see you on an upcoming episode of Sleep Science Today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.